And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Let me present to you now our three special guests for our Knights Templar roundtable discussion. Warren Gettler graduated from Princeton University in 1983. He is an investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., and is a former Wall Street Journal and International Herald Tribune correspondent. Warren is co-author of the nonfiction book Shadow of the Sentinel, One Man's Quest to Find the Hidden Treasure of the Confederacy. In addition, his paperback version is due for release November 25, 2004. That's just a matter of day or so. As Rubble Gold, One Man's Quest to Crack the Code Behind the Secret Treasure of the Confederacy. Warren has also worked as a writer for the Discovery Channel. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Warren, how are you?
I'm great, George. It's really great to be back.
Hey, by the way, have you had a chance to see National Treasure yet with Nicolas Cage?
I did, and I loved it.
Did you? We're going to talk with you about that in just a moment. William Henry is an investigative mythologist, author, and guest host of Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. In his book, The Atomic Christ, FDR, the Holy Grail, Opening the Eye of God, William reveals the secrets behind FDR's search for the secrets of the Templars, including the Holy Grail and his placement of the all-seeing eye symbol on the $1 bill. That's pretty appropriate, William, especially with this movie coming out right now. How are you?
Wonderful, George. Great to talk with you again.
You too. What have you been up to these days?
Well, I just returned from Phoenix. I was over at Dr. Chet Snow's Signs of Destiny Crop Circle Conference and had an extraordinary time out kind of poking around Sedona, some of the Flagstaff area, looking for, of all things, some of the maybe lost graves of the Anunnaki.
Oh, you may have found it, knowing you, William, huh? Glenn Kimball has a B.A. in journalism and M.A. in mass communications. In addition, he has successfully completed all coursework for a Ph.D. in communications, passing his doctoral exams, lacking the dissertation, however. He was a former president of International Exchange School, vice president of two cellular phone companies. Glenn has taught school at Southern Illinois University and was ranked by student evaluations in the top 10 instructors at that university. And that's a pretty good honor, by the way. He has been collecting ancient texts since the age of 15 and is famous for being able to integrate very diverse texts into a contiguous storyline. He is also on our panel tonight. Hi, Glenn. How are you?
I'm doing extremely well. How are you, George?
Good. I'm doing well. Looking forward to having you on this program. You bring a different perspective, Glenn, to this show. So we will be chatting with you as well about all this. You have, for how long, Glenn, looked at the Knights Templar?
Knights Templar material has been around in my library since I was 15.
That's a long time.
Some of the earliest manuscripts were were associated with a Templar recording. So,
did you always believe in your research that this group, this organization, was a good group of people, that they were out to do the best job they could for humanity, or was there something sinister behind them?
No, I've always felt them to be a protagonist, not an antagonist. They certainly their charters and their laws, et cetera, were always of the highest order. Though they were critiqued on many levels, most of the critiques of the Knights Templar were based on private beliefs and not based on realities, really.
Okay. A little bit later on, by the way, I'm going to just open up this entire roundtable to the three of you, and then we'll just all sit back and chat about some of these groups. And really, they are, William Henry, still around, aren't they?
Well, there's all kinds of neo-Templar organizations. There's at least two that have contacted me within the past year asking me to join their organizations. I've turned them down. Several years ago, we might remember the Order of the Solar Temple, which was a group that committed collective suicide over in France. And so there's been a tremendous movement towards reviving the mysteries of the Templars. And I think in our recent past here, that's largely attributed, I would suspect, to the success of such books as Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which was an international bestseller in 1982, and then recently spawned a new wave of interest in the Templars by inspiring Dan Brown's international bestseller, The Da Vinci Code. So I think that what we're looking at here is a time when the information about the Templars is finally becoming available after perhaps a period of dormancy of as many as 700 years. And now we have a tremendously inspired group of people who are trying to revive this order and really penetrate its innermost secrets.
Well, any idea, William, how many members they might have now?
No, not really, George. Some of them are fledgling organizations. Others are maybe even operating behind the scenes as well. Some of these neo-Templar organizations, in fact, I know for a fact, operate as sort of front gate operations for behind-the-scenes groups. And so it's really difficult to say how many people are involved in that Templar movement today.
All right. Warren, you have, of course, spent a great deal of your time and career to investigating and searching for Confederacy treasure. The movie National Treasure, where the Founding Fathers left clues behind for treasure and location, how realistic is that? Is that possible?
Well, George, it's a long story, and the question is, we all know that the Templars fled at some point from France, from La Rochelle, to Scotland, and they may have brought treasure with them. It can't be too well documented, but that's the story. Then the question is, did they take that treasure, as the movie suggests, from Scotland to the United States, and where our founding fathers, many of whom were Masons, protected it and hid it? There's not a lot of hard evidence for it, but in our book we talk about a neo-Templar group, as William was just discussing, known as the Knights of the Golden Circle, and they certainly modeled themselves on the Templar and buried American minted gold and silver for their own cause, which was partly Masonic.
Whose mission was it to get the Knights Templar together? I mean, somewhere along the line, somebody had to organize them and say, we need this group of people. And as I mentioned at the beginning, set up originally, I guess, to protect Christians en route to the Holy Land. Was that authentic? Is that really what their first mission was?
Well, that was the ostensible mission, but they were probably on a more specific commando mission to go find something under the Temple of Solomon, where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is today in Jerusalem, and they spent 9 years looking for something, and they may have retrieved either some sort of spiritual document or treasures themselves, and the belief is they brought that back to their headquarters in France.
Now, Glenn Kimball, their mission, of course, they were militaristic type people. Were they good soldiers?
They were very good soldiers. They were very successful in protecting both the people en route to Jerusalem and in their quest in Jerusalem. And they were very brilliant economists as well, taking the donations over 100 estates and merging them in the temple in Paris with the national treasury of France as well, and used that as the basic collateral, so to speak, to invent our modern banking systems. So they were brilliant, plus the fact that they had the ability to travel and traverse merchant traffic lanes in a wide range of far beyond what we might have thought they could have done in those days. At least historians and other people might have suggested that they had the ability to traverse.
Somewhere along the line, Glenn, they fell out of favor with the Vatican. What happened?
Well, you and I had to discuss this the last time I was on. They were declared heretics at some point in time by Philip IV and by the Pope, the papistry as well. The first and most important critique of the Templars was that they spit on the cross, that they worshipped the skull of the apprentice Mason and his widowed mother, and other things that were lesser of importance, but spitting on the cross was a very literal kind of an event for them, because the Knights Templar tradition followed the Fraternal Order of John. Each of the nine original Templars were members of the Fraternal Order of John, and when we talk about John, we mean John the Baptist. It is supposed that when Joseph of Arimathea fled Jerusalem in 36 AD in the Exodus of the Faithful, he not only took some of the famous personalities of the Bible with him, but he took the bones of John the Baptist back to the homeland of his widowed mother, the apprentice mother, back to Scotland, where these people became a political entity under themselves. And eventually the Templars, many of the Templars, believed that John the Baptist was the Messiah, and therefore were heretics, and therefore did, in at least metaphorically, spit on the cross. And this worshiping of the skull of the apprentice mason was the beheaded skull, and his widowed mother was the Elizabeth or John the Baptist. And so, in essence, they were declared heretics in a very real sense, in opposition to the Vatican's declaration that Jesus was the Messiah, and that they didn't fall into suit.
And how did the Vatican deal with them? Did they massacre them, kill them?
Well, first of all, Philip IV declared them. The Vatican declared them heretics, and then they were able to secure Philip IV's support in that. And when Philip IV from France supported them, that was tantamount to a death sentence to them. And so they were in ruin at that point in time, because their treasury was located in Paris, in the temple in Paris. And so they lost much of their political fortune. Philip IV confiscated much of their treasure at that point in time, even though many of the refugees from that Templar movement did flee to Scotland and survived later in Scotland.
All right, let's start with you, William, if we can. Give me, William, a statement, your views of the Knights Templar, what their purpose was, why they existed, and where they are today.
Well, the Templars, George, claimed to have been heirs of the Essenes, the Sons of the Light, and even the priesthood, perhaps, of Melchizedek, which I'm certain Glenn can comment on, who was the high priest of Jerusalem and who instituted not only the Holy Grail ceremony, but other mystery traditions. Melchizedek was the founder of a high order of initiates, and the Templars, including themselves, among the lineage of these initiates, and acting on apparently inside information supplied by a group of families called Rex Deos, who were considered to be, or rather claimed descent from the 24 elders of the Temple of Jerusalem. The Templars claimed that they also possessed the true teachings of Jesus and were dedicated to bringing about a kingdom of heaven on earth based upon these secret teachings passed along through these Rex Deos, or families of the 24 elders. And so what we have here are really two schools of thought about the Templars and their activity. A, you either have the exoteric, or let's say the surface historical version of the story, or you have a story, a version of the Templar story in which they are perceived more as an esoteric order, who are interested in deep secrets of the past, even secrets that have to do with profound mystery school teachings. And I can cite an example of this difference here, and it's not to take issue with Glenn's statement, but this notion that the Templars revered a person's cranium does have historical value, but it's also so that when they are described as worshiping a person's skull, as, for example, in the painting of Mary Magdalene that we have posted on the Coast to Coast AM site, what it's a reference to is a skill, a body of wisdom that the Templars possessed. And among this body of wisdom is extraordinary capabilities that unleash the powers of the human body. And when it's said that they spit on the cross, they are modeling something that Jesus did when he healed. He spit in his hands, or he spit on the ground and combined it with the clay and healed people. And so the spitting in this context is then also a reference to esoteric teachings that they possessed that were literally found in the healing qualities of their saliva.
Interesting. Interesting indeed with these people. Now, did they also become what we have now know as the Illuminati, these special groups, Masons?
Well, we always like to keep an eye on the Templars in any kind of a discussion about the Illuminati, because they are behind-the-scenes players. They were driven underground. And so there's no document that says, here is the charter of the Templars, and now we can insert the word Illuminati in place of the Templars. So most of that really is going to be of the speculative nature.
Warren Gettler, when you hear the term Knights Templars, what do you think of?
Well, to pick up on what William was saying, the theory is that when the Templars took refuge in Scotland, they came under the protection of Prince Henry Sinclair, of the Earl of the Orkney Islands, and he became sort of the founding patron of what became Freemasonry. But Freemasonry and the Illuminati were a phenomenon that happened officially in the 1600s. So Henry Sinclair was 1398 when he took his so-called voyage to America. So it evolved over time. The first Freemason lodge that was ever declared as such was 1717 in England. There were four grand lodges declared. So there's a chronology here that we have to understand. And in between the Templars and the Freemasons is another group that's historically documented and important. It's called the Rosicrucians. And Francis Bacon, the great philosopher and mathematician, was behind that. And he had a theory of establishing a utopia called the New Atlantis or the New Jerusalem. And that philosophy helped, I would say, in the exploration, the founding of our country, and influenced the founding fathers, many of whom were Freemasons.
Warren, when I was a kid, I would, I don't know where I would see these. They'd be in the back of magazines, but there'd be ads to join and become a Rosicrucian. I remember them all the time. I don't even know if they do that now, but what were they doing, trying to solicit new members?
Well, the Rosicrucians were part of what would be called the European Enlightenment, and they believed in mysticism and science at the same time, and freedom and liberty. It was the Templars and the Freemasons and the group I wrote about, the Knights of the Golden Circle, stood for a kind of revolt against despotism of the church and monarchs in Europe. And they were actively recruiting from all sorts of life, from musicians, from philosophers, from mathematicians. Newton got involved. And some people might call this the Priory of Zion, which Dan Brown writes a lot about. It's this intellectual core of free thinkers, and they wanted to recruit people like you who have open minds and who weren't trapped by the orthodoxy of the Vatican or by the monarchs like King Philip, as we discussed.
Glenn Kimball, why does it seem that one of their major missions was to accumulate treasure or wealth? Why were they doing this?
Well, I think that treasure wealth has always represented, for every banking system, a form of collateral. When you issue a check or when you issue credit or when you declare yourself a financial institution, you do so based on your asset values. The Templars were, for all intents and purposes, the inventors of our modern banking systems. And they did so. They even lent money to the kings of Europe, especially the King of France. And they did so they were able to lend money based on their assets in that were kept in either the temple in Paris or in René Le Château or in other locations. So these assets were the basis upon which they could invent the concept of issuing a check. For example, some of the very first checks that were ever written were written by the way, Islamic people, Muslims, for trade into India based on Templar banks.
Interesting. All right, stay with us, Glenn. Glenn Kimball, William Henry, Warren Gettler, all three of them have their own very unique and distinct websites. They're linked up right under their names on the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a few moments to look at those. And we'll be back again with our special roundtable discussion on the Knights Templar and the search for treasure. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our three guests, Warren Gettler, William Henry, Glenn Kimball. Warren, on the back of a dollar bill over the pyramid is an eye. What do you think that symbol means?
Well, that's the all-seeing eye, which the vice president under FDR put there on that dollar bill, Henry Wallace. And it's meant to, imply enlightenment, wisdom, and it is a key Masonic symbol, and nobody will ever know essentially what it means other than the generic idea of wisdom and vision and enlightenment.
Okay, how about you, William Henry? What do you think it means?
Oh, I totally agree with Warren that it definitely represents wisdom in the Masonic tradition. It even refers to a return of the Christ or Messiah and the prophecies, the fulfillment of the second coming. And it's important to note how that symbol got on the back of the dollar bill first and foremost. And we know that it was designed under the watchful eye of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams, being commissioned on July 4th, 1776 with the founding of America. And it had laid pretty much dormant until, as Warren mentioned, at the request of Henry Wallace and also Nicholas Rurik, a world-famous Russian mystic guru, FDR ordered that stamped on the back of the dollar bill. Now, the really key piece of information here is that they ordered this symbol stamped on the back of the dollar bill shortly after Rurik had been dispatched to Mongolia by FDR to look for the reincarnated Jesus and, in fact, the secrets of the Holy Grail itself.
So he actually sent someone to look for this?
In 1934, there was an expedition to Mongolia led by Nicholas Rurik, a world-famous Russian mystic guru who had followed the trail, the alleged trail of Jesus from Palestine through Egypt, on through India, into Mongolia, where he trained at the same lamaseries that the lamas report that Jesus trained at. And he came back to FDR and Henry Wallace convinced that he would be successful in retrieving not only the Grail, but also evidence for the second coming.
Well, this leads right into you, Glenn Kimball, of course. This search, which I assume was not successful, was it?
It was totally successful. In fact, I wrote my book, The Atomic Christ, is about this quest and the gathering of all of the evidence, A, that the expedition took place, and the references that it was successful are contained in a cache of letters written by Henry A. Wallace to Nicholas Rurik throughout the course of the expedition. Now, we don't have a smoking gun that says they found either Jesus or the Holy Grail, but the letters clearly indicate that this was the object of their quest. And if anyone's ever seen the Indiana Jones movies, we know that they were, in fact, in a race against Adolf Hitler.
Right.
I mean, I consider this, George, to be probably one of the single most important unreported stories of the 20th century because it provides the entire occult backdrop for World War II.
Well, and that was a huge backdrop as well because wasn't Adolf Hitler just obsessed with the occult?
Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, most of the Nazi high command were deeply steeped in the mysteries of not only the Grail, but they were reforming the Templars as well and modeled the SS as a new Templar order using many of the symbols, using the motivation of the Templars as the supreme master race that had access to just incredible Enlightenment teachings, which, of course, they perverted and used in a negative fashion. So it's a truly remarkable story.
And George, if I may,
go ahead, Warren.
What's interesting about FDR, as was recently profiled in a Rolling Stone piece, was he was really after the potential treasure at Oak Island in Nova Scotia, which we should talk about tonight, and which is where some people believe the Templar treasure was brought to in North America by Sinclair. So FDR, as a young man with some other very prominent people, was up there looking around, scoping around, and he, of course, was one of the 15 or so Masonic presidents that we have had.
Glenn, what's your take? Because, I mean, you have been to the Middle East. What is your take on the search for the Holy Grail and the Templars?
Well, the search for the Holy Grail, we're talking about treasures here. And by the way, can I say how honored I am to be with these two gentlemen? I'm having a great deal of fun. You are people that I hold in high esteem. When we talk about treasures, we have to remember that there were several treasures throughout history. The first one was recorded on the Copper Scroll in Qumran, indicating the demise of the Temple of Solomon. Remember, the Templars called themselves Templars after a temple treasure. That temple treasure is probably not the subject of tonight's discussion. Probably the second temple, or the Temple of Herod, that treasure is kind of a discussion for what we're talking about tonight, because when Rome was sacked Jerusalem in 70 A.D. They ransacked the temple of Herod and took all of the treasure out. Now, remember that these temples were repositories of treasure for hundreds of years. People would pay their tithings and offerings, oftentimes in gold. And many of the people who were patrons of these temples were very, very rich people and gave enormous offerings. So these temples were repositories of great treasures. But if you go to Rome to this very day, you see on the Arch de Triomphe the story in stone of where Vespasian took the temple treasure in 70 A.D. He did not take it back to Rome. He took it to the Pyrenees. Now, where are the Pyrenees? The Pyrenees are in France and Spain. So, in other words, the temple treasury of the temple of Herod, ransacked by the Romans, was taken intact to the Pyrenees in France. And people have to ask themselves, why in the world would Rome take a huge treasury, a huge treasure of enormous proportions, and take it to France?
Good question. Why?
I have my own theories. I'd like to hear what the other two gentlemen have to think about that. But that became the basis of the riches of the kings of France. And provided some of the political differences between England and France, and certainly were the basis of some of the Templar treasuries as well.
And William Henry, you, of course, have been to France. What do you think of Glenn's theory?
Oh, yeah, I think he's right on the money. He's referencing, of course, Rennes-le-Château is the stronghold where these treasures were reportedly taken. And at this juncture, if we're talking about Rennes-le-Château, it's important to note that most certainly gold in and of itself is incredibly valuable. And that seems to be the bulk of the treasure we're talking about, gold and silver. But we have to recall that gold stands for light, especially the light of the mind and the soul. And so accompanying, running right parallel to any of these gold treasures, we almost invariably are going to find, whether we're talking about the treasures of Rennes-le-Château, the treasures of the Cathars, the treasures of the Incas, we're talking about not only literal physical gold and its monetary value, but also the esoteric aspects of this treasure. We're talking about documents, about books, about lost gospels, about secret teachings that religious and political authorities have sought to prevent the masses of humanity from actually possessing. And so when we're talking there about Rennes-le-Château, that's exactly what we find when we research the incredible mysteries of that area. And some even believe that the treasure of Solomon remains there to this day, although that it's also, as Warren was saying, it's possible that it was taken also to Oak Island, Nova Scotia. And then, as he has done such a beautiful job in his book, he shows how this treasure may even have been distributed throughout the United States itself.
And it still may be around here, by the way. Was there ever, William, anything mystical about any of this treasure? Anything magical?
Well, yeah, because the Templars, among the other reasons they were persecuted by the church, was that they claimed that they possessed a piece of the true cross of crucifixion, the true cross of crucifixion. And in my view, the research that I've done reveals that this true cross of crucifixion was encoded within a medallion at the first Gothic cathedral at Saint-Denis in Paris. Now, we recall that right after the Templars returned from Jerusalem, they inaugurated the cathedral age in France. And Saint-Denis, being the first Gothic cathedral, is a very important place. And what we find in this medallion, which I've also posted at the Coast to Coast AM site, we see that the true pillar or cross of crucifixion is a combination of the Ark of the Covenant with a pillar of enlightenment attached to it. And this becomes the primary mystical teaching of the Templars, because it suggests that, A, there's a missing piece to the Ark of the Covenant that the Templars were aware of, and that when it was combined with the Ark of the Covenant, this pillar of enlightenment formed the true cross of crucifixion, which is an enlightenment teaching.
Let me ask each one of you, Warren, you first. Do you believe that the Knights Templar, almost like the Bible code, that they as an organization, as a group, they were doing something secret that they wanted to hide from the rest of society?
Oh, certainly.
that was part of their power, the money they hid underground and just their means of communication, which was passed on, I would say, into the higher rankings of Masonry, Freemasonry. And I think what's interesting now is that for so long over the past year, Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, it focused on the question of Jesus being mortal or not. But what we're talking about tonight and what's relevant to National Treasure, the movie, and our discussion, the book I wrote, is the modus operandi of the Templars, what you're asking now, George, how they secretly operated and had such power in their hands. And we can get in tonight to their modes of burying money and the types of symbology they use, the geometric sacred geometry equations they use to communicate information without using basic text, to get around, to build these secrets without spelling it out word by word.
Some of these symbols that you have found down in the South, right?
Absolutely. It's a tradition that goes way back. It involves using the symbol of the horse, the symbol of the heart, the symbol of geometric figures, all laid out. And the cross is very important. Actually, William mentioned the cathedral. At Oak Island, there is a T-shaped formation out of rocks with a big skull sculpture in the middle of it, a key symbol. And that T is what is the same basic architectural structure of the cathedrals that the Templars were involved in building. It was a hint that Oak Island is Templar or Neo-Templar. And you have to understand this esoteric knowledge known as Arcanum to follow the path. It's fascinating.
I want to talk with you more about that, Warren, next hour about Oak Island. Glenn, why do you believe the Knights Templar really became a secret society?
Well, before I answer that, I want to just add to their comments just a moment, is that if you go to the Stoke-Trye Cathedral in Great Britain, you find that they've unmasked a fresco that's on the wall from the 7th century A.D. That depicts the death of King Arthur II as being killed by Native American Indians. And behind the wall is presumed, has long been presumed, to be a piece of the true cross of Christ. But you have to ask yourself, what in the world was a fresco in the Stoke-Trye Cathedral doing on a wall depicting King Arthur II being killed by Native American Indians with loincloths and feathers and the whole nine yards 700-800 years before Christopher Columbus? Obviously, there was a connection in the Americas, and I am absolutely certain that these two gentlemen are right on track in that particular arena. But the secrets of the Templars go back to Hiram of Tyre. Most people in the world have forgotten that the purpose of temples, until you understand the purpose of the ancient temples of Solomon and the temples prior to Solomon, it's very difficult to understand the entire picture of Templars themselves. These places were not just places to burn incense and kill lambs and doves and shed their blood. These places were spiritual universities of monumental proportion, and contained within these, for example, to attend the temple during a day, it would take you nearly all day long to attend an entire session. There were people who spent years of their life doing nothing but temple work, and that doesn't mean that they were sitting there praying and burning incense and killing doves. They spent their whole lives learning in these institutions. And certainly the Masonic traditions and Christopher Knight's book, The Hiram Key, etc., tells us about many things that survived from that Templar worship. And, you know, William's book about mention of the whirling dervishes is very interesting to me, because certainly one of the activities inside the ancient temples was called the sacred dance. It wasn't a dance per se as we might know it today, but it was certainly a circle, a prayer circle of sorts, which involved both men and women, and evolved eventually through custom into a physical dance, a circle dance, or a whirling, twirling type dance for Rumi and the Shams of Tabriz, and certainly we cannot ignore that as being a part of the activities in the ancient temple. So what I'm saying is that in order to be able to understand the Templars, you have to understand that the temples were in fact a university of sorts, which not only taught religious things, but taught secular things as well, inside, which were held secret or sacred. They were sacred knowledge, much like Pythagorean's theorem was held as a religious philosophy at one point in time. There were things inside these temples that were not so much secret as they were sacred and not spoken in public.
You know, are they part of what we are now saying is this quest for a one-world government, these new Templars who exist today?
Well, we know the one-world government. The Illuminati, at least the American version of the Illuminati, was formed on May 1st, 1776. And when Benjamin Franklin and company, etc., first ordered the first die of the unfinished pyramid with the all-seeing eye on it, was in 1780, and that no one was ever, they cast that die on 8 different occasions. It was never used until Wallace and Roosevelt used it in 1936, which many people thought at that time was the fact that the Illuminati had not accomplished its financial purpose to bring a one world order in America. In fact, Wallace mentioned one time privately, he said that that the New Deal was the New World Order that he was looking for. I found that to be totally fascinating too.
Can you imagine the depth of their wealth and their knowledge in order to put together this kind of organization? And way gone back. I mean, the people who were involved with them, they must have been brilliant, weren't they?
Well, they were most brilliant. And Mr. Gettler's comments about this expedition to the Far East is absolutely true. In fact, the Dalai Lama has in his possession many texts dealing with both the ancient temples, Jesus, his apostles, writings of Jesus that are not held in our held by Christians. I find it fascinating that amongst Hindus, Buddhism, Islam, and the Jews, they have between 30 to 60,000 holy texts in their writ apiece. Christians are the only ones that have 66 books in their holy writ, and every single one of the other ones has more to do with Christ and his history and his apostles, etc., and the temples and all these sorts of things than do Christians. Christians are the least knowledgeable about Christ of all the 5 major religions.
There is a theory out there, Glenn. I find it hard to believe. However, it states that Jesus did not exist the way we would think of him as existing, but was a sacred mushroom. I kid you not. You've heard
that comes from the Talmud Emmanuel, which is written as it is an ancient text, a verifiable ancient text, written as a Jewish apology. And Sue Olson, by the way, has got a new book coming out that's going to be just spectacular. She was in Afghanistan, by the way, when the Taliban struck the Twin Towers in New York. And she was there tracking Jesus. We'll have to talk about that next hour.
Okay, well, I'll do that. And we're also going to talk about Warren Gettler's push to find this treasure that he believes could be in caves here in this country. And also we'll see what this tie-in is with Oak Island in Nova Scotia. And we'll continue with William Henry and his thoughts and theories as well. I'm George Norrie. This is a special roundtable discussion tonight on the Knights Templar. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Warren Gettler, William Henry, Glenn Kimball. Glenn, let's finish up where we left off last hour about this theory that Jesus wasn't real, but he was a sacred mushroom. What the heck is that all about?
Well, the idea that Jesus survived the cross by taking sacred mushrooms and went back to the East where he had spent some time was based on the Talmud Emmanuel. However, if you remember, Jesus' younger brother was Judas Didymus Thomas. The Didymus part was to indicate the fact that he was the look-alike little brother of Jesus. And if you actually use the more famous of the texts, or the larger, in fact, it's the largest apocryphal text in history in our possession today, the Apocryphal Acts of Thomas, it is a story of Thomas's post-crucifixion mission to India, where he died. In fact, Eusebius, the famous archbishop under Constantine, preserves for us a letter dictated or written by Jesus telling the royal family members of the East that he will not return or could not return but would send another in his place. The one that he sent in his place was his look-alike little brother, who was often mistaken for Jesus in the East. However, the rumors that Jesus survived the cross and went back to the East are probably predicated on the fact that his look-alike little brother went back to the East died later in his life, and that's where all these stories came from, rather than Jesus surviving the cross itself.
Were they symbols? The talk of mushrooms, and because they've also said Santa Claus was one.
Well, Santa Claus is another story entirely. We need to save that one for Christmas.
Yeah, that's a different show. Okay.
Jordan,
we've done that show once before, and we'll do that one again. But probably William would have a better description of that.
Yeah, may I jump in here for a quick moment,
yes,
George?
Yes, you may. We're going to go free flow this hour too,
yeah.
So feel free to jump in.
This is really key because the primary person behind this story of the sacred mushroom and the cross is John Marco Allegro, a Dead Sea Scrolls scholar who was appalled at the treatment of the Dead Sea Scrolls by conventional scholars who sought to withhold these documents from the mass of humanity for scholarly purposes, jealousy, this sort of thing. Well, so Allegro is the one who primarily is the translator of what's known as the Copper Scroll. This is thought to be the text, the manuscript that the Templars were operating from when they went to Jerusalem in search of the treasure of Solomon's temple. So after Allegro publishes his manuscripts on the Copper Scroll, the scholars all of a sudden start rejecting him, and he says, well, you know what? I've also been looking at these other texts that say that Christos, Christ, is in fact a substance, a psychedelic substance.
Uh-huh.
And so he publishes his book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, and this becomes, of course, a very controversial book in and of itself. And, you know, there's a tremendous amount of research that goes to sustain this notion that Jesus is a man. Christ is something else altogether. Now, whether Christ is, which is a Greek term meaning anointed, refers to an oil, a substance, an essence, a vibration, that's the direction that most of this research is pointed towards. And in fact, the Templars used a Rosicrucian symbol of the lily, the flower of light, to represent this enlightenment teaching associated with Jesus. And in fact, the Rosicrucians portrayed Jesus as a blue lily emerging from the cross. The blue lily in ancient Egypt was a narcotic.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
And so here we have this idea then, once again, that the Templars are privy to some kind of a extraordinary and, in fact, exotic teaching. And allegorically, metaphorically, this also accounts for their name, the Templars, because it actually refers to the real temple, which is the human brain, which sits in between the temples. And so what they had apparently had access to was a means of triggering latent powers within not only our DNA, but also within our brain itself. And this helps to account for the extraordinary leap in virtually evolution that the Templars were pushing. They were attempting to create a new kingdom of heaven on earth in which each individual would have access to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. And this is how the real Templar treasure gets enfolded into not only the Constitution, but also the Declaration of Independence itself.
Why does it seem, Warren Gettler, that they're dealing with symbols here?
Well, because they had a lofty cause, and they had to try and stimulate themselves and the masses to follow the mission without being too specific. It was a motivating factor to use symbols in it, and it involved a secret code among them that was, you know, code for throwing off tyranny. But I'd like to try and bring it back to treasure a little bit and clear up a couple of things. I do not know whether Templar treasure itself ever came to North America. I have my doubts. There's no evidence of it. The only evidence of Sinclair being here, perhaps, is the Newport Tower in Rhode Island, which is very similar to the towers on Orkney Island and the Templar Island of Bornholm in Denmark. But that's very controversial what the origin of that tower is, but there are not a lot of artifacts behind it. What I do believe, however, is that the Freemasons in the 19th century in America, under the leadership of Albert Pike, one of the most fascinating characters ever in American history, totally overlooked by historians, he was steeped in the knowledge and mystical ways of the Templars and organized a Neo-Templar repository of gold, American minted gold, under the Knights of the Golden Circle, and his system for burying and distributing this money was based on the Templars' use of geometry, the circle and a square layout, their use of astronomical indicators, symbolism, and Baconian cipher, and something called Perscher code, which is text code using keywords and otherwise. And so Pike himself was a great student of the Templar tradition. He was the most powerful Mason in the country and in the world. And he was operating in the period from the Civil War. He was a Confederate general right on through 1891 when he died. Now, in 1880 to 1890 is when Rennes La Chateau and Saunier were active in their discoveries. And they, as Holy Blood, Holy Grail points out, that Saunier and his fellow priests were members of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. The Scottish Rite of Freemasonry was led by Pike, and they were, and Pike attended a Rosicrucian conclave in Europe at the time. It's truly a fascinating connection, and it comes through Pike. And what I want to tell your listeners is, Dan Brown and I know each other, Dan Brown being the author of Da Vinci Code, of course, and
right.
He said to me, when he asked about my book, he had heard about it, and he said, "Who's the main character behind your book, Warren?" And I said, "Well, Albert Pike." And he went white, and he said, "I'm not sure I should read this. This was a year ago, because my next book is about Pike." And so Dan Brown is taking his story, which was so, you know, ingrained in the European history, and taking it now to North America through the vehicle of Pike. I think it's fascinating.
How does this group, and I want to get into some more treasure in a minute, Warren, but how does the Templars relate to Masons? And then what does this 33 degree mean? Can anybody answer that?
Sure. The Scottish Rite of Freemasonry is what many consider advanced Masonry or speculative, where it takes the York Rite, which goes up to 14 degrees, and craft masonry, lodge masonry, which most Masons you know belong to, which is the first 3 degrees, it takes it to a higher level. Essentially, there's 32 degrees within the craft, within the order, but then it takes it to 33 if you're a member of the Supreme Council. It's sort of an honorary degree. And Pike was a 33-degree Mason. And as we point out in our book, one of the key players in the mastermind plot to take this money and bury it for a cause, which was part Confederate and part Masonic during the Civil War and after, under the Knights of the Golden Circle, this Neo-Templar group. The key player under Pike, we believe, was Jesse James, who we are establishing was a 33-degree Mason, which is little known.
Well, that's fascinating all by itself. When do you think the treasure came into this country, Warren?
Well, we believe that the treasure that these Neo-Templars, known as the Knights of the Golden Circle, this subversive Confederate Masonic group, they were stealing this money from Union troops during the war, Union payrolls. They were mining it. They brought in engineers from Europe. They got involved with the Gold Rush and its successor movement in California. So basically, this was treasure that they were developing through theft. Now, there's an important connection to all this through Emperor Maximilian, who was sent by the French and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was connected to the Habsburg and Lorraine Empire dynasties, which were Templar. We can talk about that. They sent Maximilian to Mexico, and the idea is that these Confederate KGC agents, including Jesse, after the Civil War, went to try and rescue Maximilian from his plight in Mexico at the end of the war. He was allegedly killed in 67. But these KGC officers were rewarded by Maximilian by his handing over millions in gold, which may have wound up in a place called Victorio Peak. And that's where one of the biggest alleged KGC repositories was found. And it kind of disappeared over the decades. It was where White Sands Missile Base is now. And there's a big mystery to what really happened to that alleged gold find.
And what percent of the gold do you think has been found?
A small percent only. Bob Brewer and I, my co-author, I should have mentioned him earlier, who's a descendant of KGC Sentinels, we believe that there are major repositories of this gold in our country that have not been tapped we believe they still could be guarded by descendants of this organization.
Physical guarding. They're there with guns, you think?
Yeah. Bob and others that I've interviewed have been approached by unnamed people who don't identify themselves, basically saying, what are you doing here? You need to go. And these are not federal officers or anything of that nature.
Why haven't they divvied up the gold for their own purpose, for greed? Why are they guarding it? What do they plan to use it for?
Okay, and that gets back to this amazing story we're talking about. It is religious. It is a philosophy of putting this gold, which retains its value, away for a cause. And that cause, to me, I am convinced as a hard-nosed, skeptical reporter, that it has to do with the Templar tradition, which Pike was laying out in this country as a very high-ranking Freemason. And it has to do the same thing, the same type of shaft with artifacts that was discovered in Oak Island, which we talked about a little with FDR looking into it and others, is what Bob and I and others have discovered in America with the same kind of artifacts, of skulls with a horse skull, with charcoal, with skull and bones made out of wood or metal. Fascinating symbology saying this is a Neo-Templar high-ranking Masonic site, and so the mission must be for some sort of the enactment or the founding of some sort of social religious vision for the future.
Which hasn't been enacted yet.
But no, I would say this, that this group has a very long-term view. They see it as evolutionary rather than revolutionary. They're very patient.
Interesting. Is it an overthrow of our system that they want?
I don't believe so. If it is something radical, I would say that the United States, after the Civil War, became the tip of the spear for the movement, if there is such a thing. Whereas it used to be in Europe, I believe that Lincoln's fight against this movement transformed America and made America the tip of the spear for enacting change in the world.
Glenn Kimball, let's go back a little bit even further. Is there an Egyptian tie-in to any of this?
Well, there's an I want to talk a little bit about the American tie-in. I really appreciate Warren's work on this, but they're not the only ones with a repository of gold in the Americas. Certainly the Incas had I've lived in Bolivia, Chile, and Peru. Certainly the Incas had a repository of gold. Much of that was taken back to Spain. However, much of it still remains in the mountains, Andes Mountains to this day. But I have actually touched part of the treasure that's located in the western part of the United States. This is going to sound a little bit odd, but the Native American Indian, the Shoshone Indian tribe in specifically, the co-author of my second book, Hidden Politics of the Crucifixion, his name was David Sterling, was a member of the Shoshone Indian Council. And they offered to, if the United States government would give back the state of Utah to the Shoshone Indian Nation, that they would pay off the debt of the nation in gold. And I found that to be kind of preposterous at the time until David took me and actually showed me some of the gold, and I was able to handle it. Bars that are 18 inches long, an inch and a half round, pounded by hand into place, called the Tears of the Gods by the Native Americans, and our sacred treasury. They place no monetary value in this. They place a very religious value in this. And so there's huge repositories of gold still in the Western Hemisphere, and certainly that's part of the reason why King Arthur thought that Avalon was to the west. When he was standing on the Isle of Tours, he said the Isle of Avalon was beneath the constellation of Las Americas. Many people think that the Americas were named after Americo Vespucci, but Americo Vespucci is a male, and Las Americas is feminine. Being named after the constellation or stars, which are feminine. And so I agree with Warren that much of the gold did not stay in this country. Much of the gold that was found here was taken back to Europe, and evidence of that still remains today. I was able to, 2 years ago, take a personal executive guided tour of Barrick and Newmont gold mines in Nevada, where they told me that the entire reserves of gold in the world, if you were to melt it all down into a solid brick, could fit in the two car garages. But both Barrick and Newmont, which are the largest producers of gold in the world, both in Africa, the Americas, South America, and other places around the world, are all owned by the British Crown.
Wasn't there a find of some Egyptian hieroglyphs in this country, Glenn?
Yes, I've been to the site of the mouth of the Cave of the Mouth on the Mississippi River, where there are Egyptian hieroglyphs. We have all kinds of places across America that have Hebrew petroglyphs.
Now, what does that tell you?
Well, there were obviously people from both China and from Europe and the Middle East in this country long before Christopher Columbus. Our dating of our suggestion that Christopher Columbus was the first person to discover Americas, or that Leif Erikson was the first one to visit here, is totally ridiculous. There were many different migrations to this country from Europe, perhaps as far back as 10,000 years B.C., you know, or earlier. We think that the people had to cross over the isthmus after the last ice age, and my comment to them is, for goodness sake, the Egyptians worshipped the boats for a reason. It wasn't just so they could sail back to the sun. They used boats. Last time I was in Karnak, they still have boats all over the place where they sailed the world with impunity, and many of the Egyptian sarcophaguses or mummies were mummified, and the toxicology in their hair proved that they had cocaine in their hair, and they had tobacco in the embalming process of the mummies. They obviously were in the Americas as far back as 2,700 years B.C. We found artifacts off of Ipanema, which are sunken vessels from Roman vessels in the first century, where we think that Columbus was the only one to come to the Americas and say, mine, 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 and put a stake in the ground. That's what he did, and that's what he was famous for. Certainly there were people in the Americas long before that. And by the way, they came to the Americas for treasure. And Warren is right. They probably took the treasure from here and took it to there.
Yeah, the fact is on the Indians that Pike, as a Confederate general, was responsible for bringing the Indians in Oklahoma and Trail of Tears into the side of the Confederacy during the Civil War. And the KGC developed long-standing relationships with the Indians, the Apache and otherwise, including the Jesse James connection I mentioned, and Indian factors turn up in the trail of treasure that we've been on. So that's quite interesting.
All right, stay with us. And when we come back too, William, we want to check in with your neck of the woods in Nashville, in that area, find out what's going on in terms of hidden treasure there. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with our roundtable discussion on the Knights Templar with Warren Gettler, William Henry, and Glenn Kimball, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. William, tell me, in your neck of the woods in Nashville, is there any talk of treasure hidden away?
Well, there is, and I know Warren documented this as well in his book, talking about how the KGC was actually operating out of Nashville. But there's a even more provocative layer to this whole mystery. Remember, gold is enlightenment, and remember the whole gist of the Templar movement is to create this new order of the ages, the new Jerusalem, the new Atlantis. And it's claimed that when Jesus returns, he'll set up his throne in this new Jerusalem. And at this time, it's thought that the prophet Elijah will return a rod of light, a branch from the original tree of life, to the Messiah. And here in Nashville, we have a blueprint for this rod of light laid out on the ground at the base of the state capitol. It's a 2,200-foot-long rod that is laid out on 19 acres that is effectively a fulfillment of the prophecy of this rod that will appear in the New Jerusalem. And in my book, The City of Peace, and also my book about FDR's quest for the Grail, both of which you can get at williamhenry.net, I explore the amazing details of this story and how this rod came to be laid out and its connection with the Templars and their quest to bring about this New World Order.
Is it conceivable that these symbols that we're talking about and these events were created hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and they're just now being implemented now by new Knights Templar people?
Oh, sure, George, because the idea here is that these sentinels, you find them in Egypt, you find them in Sumeria, you find them in America. These organizations have roots deep in the ancient past, and might I say, roots in the stars even, because what we're ultimately talking about here are the secrets of the gods, because gold came from the gods, and what we're looking for are ultimately this connection to these godlike beings. And this brings a whole new dynamic to this quest. Why are they storing gold in these various repositories and never cashing it in?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, go ahead.
Because gold plays a prominent role anytime you are describing locations of gateways into other realms, vortex areas, and places that have high energy phenomena occurring within them. Whether you're talking about the Four Corners where Glenn is, or here in the southeastern quadrant where I'm at, you've got folks, well, for example, I'm going down to Hot Springs, Arkansas, to give a talk to the Manitaka organization, a group of Native Americans that preserve a place of peace that Thomas Jefferson was deeply interested in. He sent Dunbar into this region looking for the mounds, the ancient mounds of the original dwellers of America, wanting to know what's in those mounds and what kind of documents are preserved within those. And what we find is that in all of these locations, you find legends of massive amounts of gold, or in the case of the southeastern quadrant, quartz crystal that exists in these places. And always you have connections to godlike beings coming through holes in space in these locations. It's extraordinary.
Glenn, I'm getting a lot of fast blasts from people who want me to ask you about if there's any tie-in here with Knights Templar and Mormons. Fascinating question, but is there?
Are you talking to me, George?
Yes, Glenn.
Well, I think there's connections with the Knights Templar in many organizations, including Catholicism and Rosicrucians, and probably the more contemporary the Christian religion, the less likely it is to have a pervasive connection. I noticed, for example, when I lived in Bolivia, I went to Tiwanaku, which is far more extensive than they originally thought. And just to briefly tell you, when I got there, the natives were trying, I thought they were trying to shake my hands and take off my shoes. What they were looking for were marks on my hands and my feet. But on that, which I thought was rather curious, but nevertheless, I found a whole bunch of marks that would be prominent in a Masonic temple. The door knockers and the actual structure of the temple itself, you would have thought that the Masonic order had built the Temple of Tiwanaku. It was most curious, and certainly that was well prior to Christopher Columbus. But the answer is Joseph Smith was a Mason. He knew about that. Whether or not there are people who would suggest that the entire Mormon religion is based on the Masonic traditions, I don't see that as being the case. I think it's certainly an independent version of that, because there are so many differences in the two. But there's a lot of coincidences between that and Catholicism. If you wanted to get back to that, we can take each individual religion and make comparisons for sure.
Well, let me ask you: is it unusual that most of the founding fathers of this country were also members of a Masonic order?
I think the Masonic order was a chosen vehicle, because the Masons, first of all, were all believers in Jesus, but they were an ecumenical movement. That this was the one organization that they could use to bind these factionalized peoples together. Remember, there was a variety of religions that people came here for religious freedom, and the one thing that bound them together was their Masonic traditions, which was an ecumenical movement. It provided for the diversity in religions and the commonalities between the religions. I think the Masonic order was the absolutely quintessential, most excellent of organizations to bind the founding fathers in one movement together. Not only that, but in the case of Warren, I think that the founding fathers, I think there's always been a group out there with a treasure waiting for independent, free-thinking countries to establish themselves. Certainly at the time of the Civil War, there was a group out there, in case the South won, that were willing to step in and back up their monetary system. That's part of the reason why the United States government, our Federal Reserve, is an independent organization rather than an arm of the federal government. It's because these independent organizations are in existence around the world and are ready to step in and back up governments. And by the way, I found that to be the one statement in this movie that we talked about that
National
I think was
treasure, yeah.
That was most excellent was that these treasures are larger than one country or one individual or one group, that they are there too powerful to be kept under one group of people. And certainly they've been around waiting for independent nations to emerge and to step in and take over monetary policy, which is the real treasure. You know, governing a country or defending George Washington starved to death at Valley Forge. He didn't have a treasure. And certainly the South had many, many problems with funding their military movement. However, there were organizations waiting in the wings in the event that the South won to underwrite their currency.
Warren Gettler, why is it that every time I do a program like this, I get a lot of emails and messages from people who are part of Masonic lodges, who are doing good things for their community, caring things, yet they feel as if people take potshots at Masons? Why is there that kind of feeling?
Well, just because it's a society with secrets. Some people call it a secret society. And, you know, their rituals and their initiations and their oaths are kept secret, and nobody knows the ultimate mission. And so, you know, they don't like being accused of trying to take over the world behind the scenes. And, you know, they generally, have a reputation of doing good in the community and trying to better themselves and being charitable. And so it's part of that tradition of secrecy that is the result. I would say that of the founding fathers, it's only known about 10 of the 55 signers of the Declaration were Masons, including Franklin and Washington, John Hancock, Madison, and Livingston. They weren't all Masons. We can't be sure. Some may have been in secret. Thomas Jefferson, interestingly enough, was not a known Mason. He's revered by the order because of his belief in freedom from tyranny. The KGC looks at him with awe and honor because of that view. Even in the sense was that Lincoln became too powerful himself and became a tyrant, and so they honor Jefferson in that strange kind of role. I don't know about whether Masonry has a bad rap in this country or not. There are approximately 2 to 2.3 million Masons in America. That's the estimate, and that's about half of the world population of 4 to 5.
And do you believe that somewhere at the top they're doing things that we should know about?
We'll never know.
George, I was told one time that they call Masonry the craft, and what that stands for is can't remember a frigging thing.
I always thought they were just people who dealt with, bricklaying.
In fact, you talk with Lawrence Gardner, and he'll tell you that the Masons don't even know what secrets that they withhold. And so this is an organization that is kind of, I think they do wonderful public service, but what you find, and I've talked with a lot of Masons, is that they're not finding the secrets of their organization within their organization. They're all doing research outside of Masonry and trying to actually put the pieces together to the puzzle. It's extraordinary.
Well, you've got that here. Sorry.
No, go ahead, Warren.
Well, you've got that pyramid structure. The pyramid's important. It's a pyramid hierarchy of knowledge. Of well kept secrets, and the people at the top know more than the people at the bottom. There's no question about it. That's how it's been structured. But we talked a little bit about how the symbolism can lead to treasure and knowledge, and who was in charge of kind of laying that out. There were some very important Masons involved in, for instance, the U.S. Geological Survey, and the Surveyor General at the time of Washington was a Mason. And they communicated this knowledge about where things are and where things are important through naming cities, naming landmarks, and through conveying information through compass headings. and bearings. Again, sacred geometry. The G in masonry is believed to stand for geometry. Euclidean, Pythagorean, and you can get from one place to the next by doing triangulation and using mathematical formulas instead of communicating things directly in text.
It's that could important. Be also where some of the treasure is buried in these caves, right?
Well, absolutely. The whole method that Bob Brewer, my colleague, understood and solved was through trial and error figuring out the geometry, and it's very similar to what was laid out at Rennes-la-Château in books like Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and Tomb of God. It's a geometric and geographic-based system, grid, for these repositories.
We find the same thing in Washington, D.C., George, as well. And the Nashville tie-in with the KGC operating here is that we know that D.C.'s laid out on Masonic principles, and the Rod of Light I spoke of here in Nashville is, in fact, the sister complex to the National Mall in D.C. So what we're seeing here is that the KGC is operating in Nashville during the Civil War era and afterward, and now it appears that the tip of the spear Warren is describing is literally a spear that's laid out on the ground here in Nashville.
Glenn, you were going to jump in?
Yeah, I was going to say that I think one of the things we probably ought to be concerned about, and that is that many of these treasures, we think for some reason, were abandoned and left in the earth or left in the basements of cathedrals or et cetera, et cetera. I can't imagine any group, even the Knights Templar, who, even though they were primarily eradicated, there were survivors, ever leaving these treasures in place for long periods of time. For example, we take the Copper Scroll, which is one of the most famous of all the treasure maps in history. As people have followed the trail of the Copper Scrolls, not the least of which is Vindel Jones, none of the sites that contained within the Copper Scrolls have ever borne any fruit except peripheral things like sacred oils or incense, etc. The treasure, in essence, is all gone, has been dug up and moved from one defensible position to another defensible position. These treasures were used for collateral. They were used for the basis of economic movement, trade, merchant traffic. I think that we'll find that most of the treasures that we think are buried in the ground and forgotten for some miraculous reason were really treasures that were there at one time and moved when the reason for leaving them there as collateral or as whatever reason to defend them was over with. They were moved, and they're in the system today. Somewhere.
Right, Glenn, we found in our tracking down of KGC treasure sites that numerous sites that led to a hole that had been dug up that we believe there was a whole wholesale movement of these treasures in the 30s.
Right.
And, you know, you mentioned before about hieroglyphics and Hebrew lettering. We believe, actually, our view is that those are Masonic. That means the Masons who were involved in this KGC operation were steeped in hieroglyphic knowledge and also knowledge of Hebrew, and it was just a marker saying that this is what kind of trail you're on. I don't take the view that people from Egypt or the Middle East came to America that early on, you know, B.C. Who knows whether the Norse came, but my view is that these could be at least trail markers for this KGC
plot. You may be right. You may be right. I would respectfully disagree on a couple of levels, in that, mm-hmm. for example, in Peru, there are great petroglyphs and writings of King Ulfa from the 8th century B.C. there.
Okay.
And the traffic to the Americas, we must admit that the hieroglyphs were literally, hieroglyph means sacred writing. Mm-hmm. Hierography was the common writing. So you are right, Warren, when you say that when things were written in hieroglyphs, that they were intended to be read by priests or by kings or by special people. And so we would more likely tend to find hieroglyphy rather than hieroglyphs. And what we have found here are hieroglyphs rather than hieroglyphy. So, you know, there's an argument for and against what you have to say, and we'll have to let history decide.
It's fascinating because here in Nashville and throughout the Southeast, you find artifacts from the Woodland Civilization, say 1000 AD or so, and their symbology on their discs, on their coins, on their various paintings are precisely those that you find in Zechariah Sitchin's books about the Anunnaki. I mean, they're absolutely identical. And what we're left to wonder is, did the Woodlands people living in and around Nashville, did the Mayans of Guatemala, did the Aztecs, the Incas, did the Sumerians, the Egyptians all engage in trade with one another, or are they all tapping into a basic universal symbol system that is available to all beings that achieve a certain level of consciousness or enlightenment? And we can show example after example of communication across the oceans going back to how many thousands of years B.C. do you want to go?
And William, you're right. I would agree 100% with that. But we have to look at, we live in a world where history has been as sheltered as anything in the world. We have, for example, letters written by the Irish monks that lived in St. Louis at Monk's Mound from the 8th century A.D. to the Vatican that still exist in the archives in Reykjavik, Iceland. Now, what in the world is mail service doing 700 years before Christopher Columbus between the Americas and Italy? The reason we don't have that in our common history books is because no one acknowledges it. And, you know, Gunnar Thompson said it best when he wrote his trilogy of books. He said that he could not get a book published by any of the historical societies or publishers in the nation for any topic that preceded 1492.
Exactly. I think the whole question of Columbus discovering America is starting to fade. And, you know, the conventional history has it that way. But there's evidence that, you know, the Leif Erikson and the Norsk and possibly even Sinclair made it over earlier. That's to be debated. Whether they brought treasure over is uncertain at this point.
Well, one thing they did bring was the blue lily, which is an anomalous flower found in Nova Scotia that is of Egyptian origins.
Hold on, guys. I got to take this break. Just ahead, we'll take your phone calls. When you call in, just tell us who you want to talk to, Warren, William, or Glenn. That way I can organize this a little easier for all of us. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast. Warren, William, and Glenn, before we go to the phones, I want each of you to be able to get your website out and pass on some information to the multitudes that listen to the program. Warren, why don't you go first?
Sure. We have Rebel Gold is the name of our paperback. You can get it on Amazon.com. Just type in Rebel Gold, and the hardcover is called Shadow of the Sentinel. I don't mind people emailing me, Gettler, G-E-T-L-E-R, 99, at AOL.com if you have questions, and I can get back to you, okay?
William Henry.
Oh, thank you, George. Yeah, visitors can come to WilliamHenry.net. My books in particular on this subject are The Atomic Christ and also City of Peace, and it's my desire to offer to the Coast listeners, anybody that orders from this show, just say, hey, I was listening to Coast, and I'll send you a free copy of my brand-new lecture DVD, Stargate 2012. I have a phone number, too. That's 615-292-7863, and I hope you'll come to my site, check out my upcoming Egypt trip and all kinds of special events coming up.
Excellent. And you, Glenn?
My website's www.ancientmanuscripts.com. And I think the key to understanding the Templars is the 37 years just following the death of Christ and the riches that went to the West. And that's contained in my CD called AD After the Death of Christ. And it's available there. And my telephone number is on the website, too, for those who wanted to talk to me. And there's some specials there as well. And I just wanted to say what fun it's been to be with these two gentlemen. I've enjoyed it very much.
Likewise, Glenn. Thank you.
Let's go to the phones now and really enjoy ourselves. Let's go to our wild card line where the first call is going to be for you, Warren Gettler. Hi there. What's your name and where are you calling from?
My name's Alan. I'm calling from Salt Lake City, Utah.
Hello, Alan. Go ahead for your question for Warren.
All right, Warren. I just had some information. There's supposedly some mines that the Mormons used when they first came to Utah to pay for, like, the Salt Lake City Temple. They also have, like, an angel Moroni on top of the temple. It's made out of gold entirely. And I guess there's a man named Caleb Rhodes who would go out with the Indians to these mines, and he said that there was enough gold there to pave the streets of New York with gold. And he actually petitioned the U.S. Congress to try to take a land lease out and in exchange pay the national debt. But have you ever heard of anything like that?
Alan,
there's a couple of websites on the internet that talk about their treasure website that talk about a lot of things going on in Utah.
And links
to the Knights of the Golden Circle or Freemasonry and Smith's possible links there. I don't know personally. It's not something I've actually researched, but you can find some of this on the internet and start researching. I think it's a fascinating trail.
How did you get involved in this treasure hunt, Warren?
Well, I used to be a senior writer at Discovery Channel, and I was lecturing at a university in Oklahoma about what I do, and these women came up, and after I presented to the class, talked about Jesse James' treasure being taken off their property, and they showed a videotape of these gold coins being taken from their property. Well, the guy who had given these women the tape was my eventual co-author, Bob Brewer, who had turned the tape in saying he apologized for trespassing, his partner hadn't told him, and that he'd help the women find the bigger gold that was on their property if they met with him. So I asked to meet this guy. I came to him. He didn't come to me. And he started telling me, just hold your hat, kid, because I've got a hell of a story to tell you if you're patient. You can walk the line with me, and I did over 7 years. And it was just an amazing quest of discovery for me. I was out there with him in the archives and in the field. We dug up hearts, these symbols that are being found at these treasure sites that are found in Oak Island. He showed me his gold coins, and we took it from there. We were just on Nightline on Friday with the big show, and the Washington Post just ran a story about us this Sunday.
Well done. West of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. And who's your question for?
Hi, this is Bill from Tucson. My question is for William.
Sure thing.
I wanted to make a brief comment and then a question, William. I believe you mentioned the universal symbology, which basically links all of the religions of the major religions of the world into this this system of gematria. And I've been doing probably 90% research on what you're all talking about tonight. And I've discovered that the 12th layer of the pyramid structure itself is the title of Rex, which is the title of Pontifex Maximus. And there is one place on planet Earth right now where all of the universal symbology of everything that all three of you gentlemen have been talking about can be found. And it's within the structure of the Latin word Vatican, which in Latin means the divining serpent. And it is the title of the Pontifex Maximus, the Pope himself, who wears the holy sacred ephod of Babylon around his neck, and he's the only one on planet Earth that has that. And I just wondered, have you done any research into the Vaticanus?
Well, of course, and I've also, in my book, Cloak of the Illuminati, wrote about the power garments worn by various prophets throughout history, Elijah, Enoch, possibly even John the Baptist, and the way that I interpret this is that the garments worn by the Pope are actually, in my view, more symbolic than they are actually the power garments that we're referring to. I just see just tremendous example after example of the way all of the prophets have attempted to tap into this universal source of consciousness, and their ability to tap into that is often reflected symbolically by the garments that they wear. For example, the fish hat worn by the Pontifex Maximus, by the Pope, is actually an ancient Sumerian symbol, and it's a reference to the Sumerian god Ea, or Enki. And it's thought to have some form of a, perhaps even a communications capability. And I know that Glenn has also spoken frequently and written about the Pontifex Maximus, so I'm going to ask Glenn if he'd like to comment on this as well.
Well, I think you do a much better job of talking about the mysticism than I do, and for that I have deep respect for you, William. My comment is that the vestments, we go back to ancient Greek, for example, and when Jason was looking for the golden fleece, remember what the golden fleece represented. The golden fleece, or the golden ram skin, was symbolic of the priestly robes worn by Melchizedek. And so, even getting into Rumi and the vestments of the Shams of Tabriz and Rumi, these vestments were in common and extend all the way through the Knights Templar as well, the robes, the aprons that they wore in their ceremonies. And, and the vestments that were used by not only the Knights Templar, but the crusading knights under Richard the First and et cetera, were all symbolic of the same kind of vestments. So I think that's interesting.
The Templars, for example, wore a rope, and that it's thought that this rope itself even had healing capabilities. But again, this is a symbol. This is a symbol of an actualized human being, a person who knows the secrets of transforming an ordinary human into a higher being. And that, once again, is ultimately the primary treasure of the Templars. It's all about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that we all take for granted on a daily basis. We have no idea in America what a revolutionary idea it was to give the average individual access to the sacred mysteries, access to this knowledge that we're describing. And it's a kind of a commentary on our state right now that we are not doing so. Instead, we have maybe 9/10 of the population that has zero awareness of what we're describing tonight, but yet this is the focal point of our times, the ability of the individual to transform themselves into a being that was once only dreamed about.
Yeah, that's where the expression as above, so below comes from in that sense.
East of the Rockies, you're up now on Coast to Coast. Who's your question for?
Yes, my name is John. I live in Liberty, Missouri, and this question is for Mr. Kimball and
the
panel as a whole, whoever wants to answer it. And that is, I was wondering if they're aware of the Luciferian nature of the mysteries of this of these conspirators, and that Mr. Pike was an espoused Luciferian who wrote a letter that was on display in the Royal Museum for several decades to a Mason named Mazzini, in which the three world wars were laid out, and obviously the two have happened, but the third world war was to occur in the Middle East, which is, of course, happening right now. And I also must say that according to all the prophets, the Messiah of these men will be the Antichrist, and I guess I just wonder if you'll comment on that.
We'll get your reaction, Glenn. Thank you, John.
Well, I think that there's, you know, certainly the all-seeing eye was a description of seeing good and evil, and I think that you could take a view of the Knights Templar and their symbology and look at it both as the an illumination of the Luciferian traditions as well as the Messianic traditions, and I happen to agree with this gentleman that it's very common for people to take one side or the other. I think it's more beneficial to look at both sides of this and to fulfill the actual intent of the all-seeing eye, which was to look at the good and evil and arrive at better understanding. And I think William would agree with me on that.
All right, very good. Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing? My name is Jason. I'm calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Hi, Jason.
I got a question, but first I got a comment. First, I want to say it's awesome getting in. It only took me 12 months. But I think I finally got it down. I think I know how to get through more often now.
Don't give away the secret.
No, right. I won't, because then I'll never be able to get in.
Yeah, you got that right. Who's your question for, Jason?
My question's for Warren. If I'm wrong on this, correct me, but I believe it was Warren that was talking about the gold being guarded by the guys with the guns.
Yes.
Okay. My question on that is, why hasn't the government done anything about it, or do they not know about it, or are they working with these people?
That's a great question. Again, it's one that can't be answered with any kind of conclusiveness, but I'll just say that my colleague got notification from somebody that the government was snooping around for this under some sort of cover, if you will, in one area. So I think the government's probably interested in it. Let me just say this, that whenever Jesse James's gold has been discovered in the past, according to our research at the Library of Congress and the National Archives, an FBI van turns up and takes the money. Because, again, most of this money that's buried is federal money. It was stolen by the KGC. And, you know, they have a claim on it in some sense. Insurance companies could have a claim on it. And all I can tell you is it would be my guess that the government would be interested in getting these KGC mega depositories.
If you had to guess, Warren, and that's only what this is, how many millions or billions of dollars worth of treasure gold are tucked away in this country?
I don't know. My own personal estimate would be hundreds of millions or more. An article in the L.A. I'm forgetting the name. L.A. Examiner. It's no longer in existence. It had $100 billion in KGC money buried in America. That was a 1974 article.
And as gold goes up, so does that price, right?
That's right. I mean, this is valuable money because it has historic and numismatic value, not just the specie value, the actual printed money on the coin. So it's extremely valuable.
Next up, Wildcard Line, you are on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, Joe calling from Austin. A question for William Henry on
Joe.
The back of the dollar bill, the pyramid, I've noticed something that I've never heard commented on before. Down at the base, if you look at the pyramid on the left side, it's dark, as if a shadow's falling over it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And if you look at the base of the pyramid, just above about 2 o'clock from the inn in Novus, there's a little figure down there, and to me, it looks like an owl, and that, of course, makes me think of Moloch and Bohemian Grove.
There is an owl on the front of the dollar bill as well, so I can't detect it on the bill that I'm looking at right now, but I see what you're saying. I see the outline of the figure that you're describing. I know it has one side is light, the other side is dark, representing the duality, and ultimately, the owl does symbolize Minerva, the goddess, and also ultimately wisdom as well, so very interesting comment.
Yeah, it helps if you get a jeweler's loop or a good magnifying glass, and it pops up pretty clear.
Okay.
I wouldn't mind adding that, you know, in some of the coded maps that we've seen related to the KGC, an owl is very apparent there looking in a certain direction.
Someone emailed me and said that if you can look at the eye with a magnifying glass, it will look like a reptilian eye.
It's also just like the logo of the movie Stargate. They centered that movie on the pyramid, and, of course, the gateway opens. And just above that, it says Argo, which is the ship of the gods, which is, of course, a gateway or a wormhole.
I'm a little depressed that I have more dollars with these pyramids than 50s or 10s. Why did they change the back of the bills? How come they didn't all stay the same?
Well, in particular, the $1 bill, I can tell you that it was, in my view, like raising a flag up the pole that told Hitler, hey, or to those in the know, that they were successful in their expedition to Mongolia to retrieve the secrets of the Grail. Now, whether or not that included the reincarnated Jesus or not, we can't say for certain, but it did suggest that America is open for business in terms of the Second Coming is concerned, and that is, in fact, the business of America. It's the American enterprise, if you will. Its goal is to bring about this kingdom of heaven on earth. And that's the role of each American citizen, is to contribute to this idea of the spreading of liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And that's something, once again, that we all need to cherish and to really think about in terms of what that means into our personal lives.
Do you think the people, either one of you, who heads up the Federal Reserve, like Greenspan, do you think they might be part of the Knights Templar? Who wants that?
I don't have any data on that. Maybe someone else can answer that.
Warren? Glenn?
I think he ought to be president of the United States. That's my opinion.
You like him that much?
I really do.
All right. That's interesting. He's part of the secret societies, though, Glenn, isn't he?
Perhaps so, and I want to know his secret because he's kept this country balanced for a long time.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hello. Masons are always seeking light. Who has this light? Now, in Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma, on page 321, he says that it's Lucifer.
How about a question? Who are you addressing to?
Glenn.
Anybody in particular? Glenn?
Well, Lucifer's real original name was Son of the Morning, or the Son of Light, and anciently, the philosophy was that he was the brightest of all the sons of the gods, and that's part of the reason why his fall in the pre-existent earth was so great, was that he was so intelligent. But once again, My comment to everyone here is that the real purpose of mortality was not to gain knowledge because we knew more before we came here. The real purpose of this earth itself was to understand the difference between good and evil. And the fact that Lucifer was intelligent is just part of that process of understanding the reason that the prime directive of the universe is goodness and not evil.
And welcome back to Coast. Warren, how close is National Treasure, the movie, to reality?
Well, the founding fathers were interested in creating a nation that was, you know, in going to create a land of liberty and equality and fraternity, as it suggests. Maybe they did have some inkling of treasure somewhere, but I think the backstory of the Templars being a force that led to the creation of America is a possibility through what we talked about before: Bacon's vision, the Rosicrucians, the atmosphere that they come out of. But the idea of them having this huge treasure, if you've seen the movie, that was brought over from, you know, the Middle East, from Egypt, Israel, wherever, is a little bit far-fetched for me.
All right. Now, you talked earlier about Oak Island, Nova Scotia. Why is that so important here?
Well, Oak Island's important because there could be some sort of treasure, either monetary or spiritual, that let's say academic, that was buried there. Maybe not by the Templars themselves. It could have been brought over, say, in the 1600s as opposed to the 1300s. And the symbolism there, that the artifacts that have been found there, the inscriptions and the artifacts in the shaft, are very similar to the layouts that we've been finding of the KGC, the Neo-Templar. So for me, it's hugely fascinating. And, of course, the National Treasure movie has a kind of combination of KGC background and Oak Island background to it.
To the phones we go. Let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, George. Yeah, great show as always. I just wanted to let you know I'm calling from Lihue, Kauai. It's a beautiful night tonight.
Oh,
my question was for William. How many versions of the greenback have been printed through the history since we've converted from silver to gold?
Sorry, I don't know the answer to that trivia question.
Oh, really?
Warren, would you know that answer?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Wow. I was kind of stunned. I thought somebody would have knew that answer.
And I don't. But because you got through, any other follow-up questions that you want to ask any of them?
Well, no, I'm just excited to see the movie. I hear it's a really good show. So
I do have another comment, though, George.
Thanks, Mike.
After Henry Wallace and Nicholas Roerich and FDR reenacted the archetypal drama of the three wise men looking for the reincarnated Jesus and the secrets of the Grail, it was Wallace's desire to become Secretary of Commerce. And this was because he understood, I feel, the power of money as a symbolic vehicle. Most people don't realize that every time you hold that dollar bill in your hand, you're holding what is called a magic sigil that connects you to the magical symbolism that's contained on that mystery school book that we call the $1 bill. And it's very interesting to note that the symbols that we find that are so rampant throughout the ancient world were collected, for example, by the Cathars, and it's actually the Secret Service that is the largest collector of watermarks and ancient symbolism in the world. And it's alleged that they are collectors of these symbols to combat counterfeiting. But I would suspect that there may be an even more profound reason for that.
Glenn, you know, as we talk about these various issues with regards to the Knights Templar, it still baffles me that they've been able to do whatever they do with this shroud of secrecy. How come this hasn't been publicized in the mainstream media?
Well, like I've suggested many times, I don't think it's quite secrecy as much as sacredcy. And Warren was right. The people at the top know the difference between something sacred and something secret. When you get to the very top level of both politics, monetary movement, banking, etc., as well as religion, things make a lot more sense, and you cross over the arbitrary boundary lines of politics and economies and religions. We at the bottom sometimes are separated by what we're told and what we understand. I don't think that things are as secret as we think they are. Certainly, for example, on my website, I've collected hundreds of texts written by the masters in history that speak about these topics. And if you were lucky enough to have read them all, you would have quite an open. You'd find out that this information is quite open and quite prevalent. I've often said that all you need is a good library card, and you can find out almost anything.
George, I'd like to answer that, too, if I may.
Sure, go ahead, Warren.
I think there are two reasons. It's too darn complicated, what we're talking about, to kind of put in a neat box. And secondly, there's just some, you know, for every theory, and we've been talking mostly about theories, there's an alternative theory that you can put forward. And the academics and the media, and I come from established media, you know, want to have hard facts, and I try and stick to that. So where there's always an alternative theory that could explain your necessary but not sufficient condition for proving this, then you've got a problem. So we're in that incredibly intriguing area of mystery and logical conclusions, but there's not enough hard proof to get a lot of people excited. However, with movies like National Treasure and The Da Vinci Code coming out, the public consciousness is more and more aware of this amazing story of the Templars and their role in Europe and now potentially in America. The Europeans have known more about the Templars than we have, but that's slowly beginning to change.
Well, that's true.
Let's go easy. There's another great show coming out on TNT. My buddy David Titcher wrote it. It's called The Librarian. And the premise is that this person presumes that he's applying for a job at the New York Library, and he's actually applying for a job as the curator of the relics the United States government has stolen from other countries.
Oh, that's a great show.
And it sounds like it's going to be absolutely fantastic. I think it debuts on December 5th on TNT, so that'll be kind of nice. And he's got some nice Oak Island stuff in there and tips his hat to FDR and some of the research that I was doing, so I appreciate what David's doing.
Back to the phones, east of the Rockies. Hi there.
Good morning, Mr. Norrie.
Good morning to you, and who is your question for?
I believe Warren, sir.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm from the Delmarva Peninsula out on the East Coast. There's an urban legend around here of a swamp area where a Confederate high-ranking officer killed his slave and buried a huge treasure in gold. He cut his slave's head off to guard the gold. Is that just an urban legend, or is that like any truth behind that to hide gold for the Confederacy?
I wouldn't know. I don't know enough about that particular case, but there is a lot of urban legend mixed in with real stories. But the KGC did have cover stories, usually about Indians attacking a wagon load of Spanish treasure or whatnot, or Union troops. And it usually involves that kind of tale. That was a cover story to alert their people that there is a depository in that area, but they used a cover story to kind of throw people off. The most interesting thing about your area is the so-called Beale treasure, which everybody's heard about, and it involves references to the Declaration of Independence, to Thomas Jefferson, and I believe that is a KGC treasure involving a man who worked with Pike named Caleb Cushing. Very interesting guy, because if you look in his files at the Library of Congress, he owned mining interests in Bedford County, Virginia, where the so-called Beale treasure is. It's a famous code, the Beale Code, and it's very much this kind of code, Baconian cipher and whatnot, that the KGC used.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, appreciate it. By the way, Spike Mike from the Fantastic Forum has sent me an email with some incredible pictures that he's taken, close-ups of a dollar bill, and you'll see the owl in one, the great seal in another, and it's really strange stuff. I mean, there's some symbolism, Warren, on this dollar.
Oh, absolutely. And trust me when I tell you that out on the trail we see the all-seeing eye. We see references to pyramids or pyramidal shapes, owls. Everything that you've talked about is out on the KGC trail. There's no question about it.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
thank you. This question is for William. I'd like to get William's definition of the entity that the Templars worship, known as Baphomet or Baphomet, and was Baphomet a Rosicrucian or a Catholic? Is there a connection to those groups?
That's an awesome question. Thanks for asking it. The Knights Templar were persecuted by the Church because they worshipped a head or a skull called Baphomet. And the Templars, it is claimed, believed that this skull could perform miracles. And the question is, what kind of a head or a skull has the ability, for example, they said the head could save them, that it could make riches, it could make the trees flower and make the land germinate. What kind of a head can make riches? We're talking about a body of wisdom, a skill, not a skull, that is capable, that enables the apprehender of this wisdom to transmute the elements. We're talking about alchemy, because it is alchemy that can make riches, that can make the land germinate. And it's ultimately concealed behind this symbolism, even within the skull and bones, of this idea of this ancient mystery school teaching about transmuting lead into gold, but ultimately, how do we transform the impure soul into a golden soul or a pure soul? That is the very basis for all of these secrets that we're talking about tonight. And it's symbolized once again by the skull, which is a skill, a school, a body of wisdom.
William, on that note, I just want to pipe into the listener who asked that question. You can see a huge sculpted skull in our book, Rebel Gold, Shadow of the Sentinel, pointing to an area where we think there's treasure in Arizona. And also, if you read a book called Oak Island Secrets by Mark Finnan, you'll see that Oak Island produced a large skull in the middle of this geometric T that's formed by these boulders. So definitely it's a Templar sign and the importance of the skull that William was talking about.
Yeah, in Egypt it was called the Head of God. And Mary Magdalene, in fact, as I pointed out earlier, was often painted holding a skull. This is not the cranium of an individual, be it John the Baptist or Jesus. This is a symbol for what in Egypt was the pillar of the high priest. In fact, that is one interpretation of the name Magdalene, which is Magdal, meaning pillar. Mary was the pillar of the tribe. And we find all kinds of references returning us to this idea of a pillar of enlightenment, as, for example, the pillar that's attached to the Ark of the Covenant. And you can, once again, if you visit my site, williamhenry.net, I present it on the front page of my site, because it is the tree of life of the Garden of Eden. It is the primary symbol that represents the enlightenment of humanity.
In fact, the skull is the symbol of a master mason, skull and bones, the skull and crossbones. It's a symbol of the KGC. It's a symbol of the Skull and Bones Secret Society at Yale. And I think it all has to do with what William was describing.
I was going to say the Secret Society at Yale, of course, Skull and Bones, really hasn't been a big issue tonight. Is there a reason for that?
Well, because what they're doing here, George, is just simply passing along symbols that they more than likely don't even themselves know what it means. Craft, remember, means they can't remember what they're talking about. They're just passing along symbols without fully apprehending the original meaning of them, and that's how all this veil of secrecy gets placed around some of these organizations. They're just fraternal brotherhoods, essentially, that are, in my opinion, empty of the original mystery school teachings that upon which they were founded.
Was that you back there, Glenn, saying something?
Yeah, I just wanted to remind everyone that all nine original members of the Knights Templar were originally members of the Fraternal Order of John, and for a reason. And I just wanted to contribute that. I know that people would say that the symbology is lost or that it's empty. I'm not so sure that it's so empty or that it's lost.
Next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're up. Hi there.
Yeah, I wanted to know if they had any kind of connection between the Masons or even the Templars about the Georgia stones that are just outside of Elberton, Georgia.
Anybody want that? Anybody know about that?
You'll have to refresh my memory. I have heard of them, but I can't recall exactly the details right now.
I believe it's five individual monoliths with a top piece. It lines up geometrically also for the setting of the solstice and the equinoxes, and it has a warning in, I believe, 7 to 8 different languages.
That's right, and it aligns itself with the Cross of Hendaye written about by Jay
right.
Widener, a cross in southern France, very near Rennes-le-Château, that warns of a double cataclysm at the quote-unquote end of the world. And I think this is an important point to make here, too, George, because we've had several callers asking about what Albert Pike thought about Lucifer. What Albert Pike thought about Lucifer is really not really penetrating the ultimate mystery of what we're describing here. The great cross that these figures revered is actually a celestial alignment with the center of our Milky Way galaxy that occurs in 2012. Lucifer is the light that comes through that great cross, and this celestial alignment acts as a crucifix to fasten or bind this light to the earth plane. And both the Cross of Hendaye and these tablets that the gentleman is describing point to this moment in time when the light of God reappears on the planet.
Well, you guys have done your homework, I'll tell you that. You, Glenn, William, and Warren, we've only got a few more minutes left. So once again, Glenn, mention your website. You have a toll-free order number for your books as well.
I do. It's 888-904-9394. And it's ancientmanuscripts.com, and I put together a selective list of the masters who've written about the Templars. And remember that the secret for the Templars really originates in the 37 years following the death of Jesus and the massive movement to the West, and that's encapsulated in my CD, AD After the Death of Christ. And once again, what a delight to be with these two gentlemen. I've had a lot of fun.
William Henry, your website again, please.
My website is williamhenry.net, and my telephone number is 615-292-7863. And once again, I'm extending the special offer that if you order any of my books or other DVDs, I'll send you a complimentary copy of my brand-new lecture, Stargate 2012. And I just wanted to mention one more thing, George, and that is, on this Thanksgiving weekend, let's remember the pilgrims that came here on the Mayflower, and let's just remember that the Mayflower is the flower of light, the lily. And let's take a moment this weekend to celebrate the awakening, the enlightenment that America ultimately provides to each and every soul incarnate on this planet. And let's say a prayer for those that are also attempting to attain this ideal that is our birthright by virtue of living in this country.
Indeed. Thank you, William. And Warren, how about your website one more time?
Thanks, George. Thanks for having me on the show, and thanks to William and Glenn. The name of the book is Rebel Gold. That's the paperback on Amazon.com, out with Simon & Schuster. And the hardcover is Shadow of the Sentinel, One Man's Quest to Find the Hidden Treasure of the Confederacy. It's with Bob Brewer, my co-author. And, we don't go as deep or far afield into these subjects as my colleagues here on the show. We try and stick to the Civil War period and its Templar background, but these are fascinating issues the other guys have raised on the show.
Warren's book is awesome, indeed. By the way. Absolutely awesome.
Well, all of you, you all three of you have done just a tremendous job, considering that we're on four separate lines, me and you three. So thanks again, Warren, William, and Glenn. Thank you so much.
Thanks, George.
Thank you, Glenn. Thank you, Warren.